Hi, I'm Simon Helberg, and you are listening to Improv Nerd with Jimmy Curain.
Jimmy Curain's a nerd. Jimmy Curain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Curain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Curain, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. And this episode is sponsored by the Tampa Bay Improv Festival, which is November 17th through the 19th. Now, if you haven't visited Tampa Bay in November, you're missing the sunshine and an improv revolution. Last year's festival brought together teams from New York, Chicago, Austin, Boston, San Francisco, London, and other great cities for 3 days of sold-out shows and workshops. Submissions are open until August 31st at TampaBayImprovFestival.com. Join the party in Florida. Do Tampa Bay Improv. This episode is also sponsored by the Green Bay Improv Festival, which is celebrating 5 years of bringing the best improvisers to Northeast Wisconsin. This year's festival will run October 21st, 22nd, 28th, and 29th, and they're now accepting submissions now through August 31st. Submissions are being accepted via the Improv Network at theimprovnetwork.org. For more information, check out the Green Bay Improv Festival on Facebook. And if you like this episode of Improv Nerd or any past episodes of Improv Nerd, please do me a favor and write a nice review on iTunes. It really helps with my low self-esteem. We have another great episode of Improv Nerd for you today. Our guest today is Simon Helberg. You know him as Howard from the CBS hit sitcom The Big Bang Theory. But did you know he had a sketch background? He studied at the Groundlings and was part of the sketch duo Derek and Simon with Derek Waters. And now he's starring along Meryl Streep and Hugh Grant in a new movie, Florence Foster Jenkins, directed by Stephen Furze. The movie comes out August 12th. Talk to Simon about following in his father's footsteps and going to the Groundlings, working with Meryl Streep and what he learned from her, and the importance of loving what you do and figuring out if what you're doing you really love. Before we do this interview, this is the fifth week that I'm a father, and I'm really kind of reconsidering my decision. I don't know if it was the right thing to do. I've been depressed. Now, they say typically that after birth, the mother can get what they call postpartum depression. But I don't know. Lauren doesn't seem like she's depressed at all. I'm totally depressed. And I have to admit this, that I was in such denial about, like, this changes your life. This changes every second of your life. And I didn't realize that. You know, I don't know where my head was the first couple weeks. I think actually I was in shock. But now I'm just like, what have I done? What have I done? You know, this is like a long-term commitment. I just can't go back and turn it in to the store or the hospital. I'm stuck with this. And right now I'm just like, oh my God, you know? So I hope this will pass. And I really do, because Lauren's loving it. And Lauren is such a great mother. And you know what? Here's the thing. I'm a really good father. You know, I do love holding her and you know, when she cries a lot, you know, there's been days where she nonstop crying, like, you know, you're waiting for the batteries to burn out and they don't. Those days can be really trying. But right now I'm just depressed. And like you wanted to hear that. You probably, and here's the thing, when people have babies, they want to tell you how great they are and this is great and whatever. But it's hard. It's really hard. At least for me right now, it's really hard. So I'm not discouraging you. And hopefully, like in a couple months, and someone told me this, that the father, it takes a while for the father to connect to the baby and to feel that joy. So just hang in there with me, will you? Hang in there with me, because I hope, like, in a month or 2 months, I look back and I just, like, I can't believe I said that. But you know what? I'm not changing a word of this. Here it is, the Simon Helberg interview. And I just want to turn this over. It's a little shorter. It's chock full of great stuff. It really is. But it's a little shorter than our typical interviews, because he was doing a press junket. And they only give you, they come in for a day, and they only, you know, they schedule it very tightly, and they're very rigid about the time, and they should be, because they're doing one interview to the next, they're doing a newspaper and then a radio station, and then they have Improv Nerd, which of course I feel a little shame about, and I admit it to them, because I probably owe them an amends, but I sit down with the guests and I'll say something like, hey, you know, this is how Improv Nerd works. I didn't mention the title of Improv Nerd, and I didn't do it because I felt shame about that. Like, I'm doing this improv thing, and so, and then, you know, I didn't, it was stupid. I shouldn't have done that. I should have told them what the name of the podcast is. But I do, we do address it at the beginning. So here it is. You're going to love this episode. The Simon Helberg episode. Enjoy. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd. Thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you. That's what you're called. You just waited till now? No wonder you buried the lead on this.
Yes. I'm sorry. I felt a little shame about telling you it was about improv.
I'm out of here.
Okay.
No, I've won. But improv's fine. It's the nerd
part. You have an improv
part,
sketch background.
I do. There's a lot of pressure here. But nobody can see us, right? So we could have scripted this.
Yes, we could.
We should have. We should have worked last night on making this really good. I do have an improv background, a little bit. I come from a sort of a long line of improvisers. My dad was in the Groundlings, so I grew up around that in Los Angeles and loved it, but never wanted to really get up necessarily.
Why didn't you?
Well, okay. Actually, I think the truth is I did want to get up there, but I chose other things to focus on. I wanted to do music for a long time, and I probably was kind of scared because my dad was so great, and I got to see these amazing people, Phil Hartman, and all of these geniuses. So I shied away. But then by the end of high school, I just kind of couldn't resist, and I actually went and studied at the Groundlings, and I went to study acting at NYU, and then I went back to LA, and then I did a bunch of sketch comedy. I did more sketch stuff than I did improv.
Because I first knew of you through Simon and Derek.
Yeah, Derek and Simon, please. Derek would be okay, very upset. Right. It's alphabetical. It's okay. Not talent.
Okay, there's no egos involved.
It's not. It might be height also, but it's definitely not anything else. Yeah, so Derek and Simon, which was something that... Siren. That was something I'm still so proud of, and it came about from doing sketch stuff. And Naomi Odenkirk, Bob Odenkirk's...
Who's a manager.
Yeah, wife. Manager. Yeah, who managed Derek, said... And Derek and I had completely opposite sensibilities on stage, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had a great time together. We just never... I was more of, like, you know, Martin Short, and he was probably more of, like, you know, Bob Odenkirk or something. You know, it's just a different vibe.
And definitely different energies, too.
Different energies, too. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, he's got a slower way of... Just he's different. And so Naomi said, "You guys should do something together. You're like kind of the same height again with the height, but you have such a different vibe." And so she got Bob, and the three of us went into a room, and we started talking. And Bob was just writing down what we were saying. And we went to HBO and basically said, "Hey, Bob wrote down our conversation, and it's kind of funny, and we have some ideas, and it would just be us sort of walking around LA." Looking for girls, we sold it, and it was great. And we had Zach Galifianakis was in it, and Bill Hader, and we ended up making it into these webisodes. And all this was like slightly before this made any sense to do. People didn't know what a webisode was, so it was a little before its time, and it was really great. And I almost wish, in some ways, that it had come about when there was more of an audience for it, because it was so awesome. But
how does that help you get cast in Big Bang Theory?
Well, that's the thing, is it doesn't. Okay. and actually, I had a moment not that long ago where I was sitting with my friend Jeremy Connor, who edited Derek and Simon, and now he directs all of Drunk History with Derek, and I said, man, I kind of wish that Derek and Simon was a few years later. You know, UCB wasn't even around, and like. And the internet wasn't Funny or Die, and if it had come about later, I feel like I really would have. And he's like, "What? Been on the biggest show in the world?" Oh wait, you already are on the biggest show in the world. And I thought, oh, yeah, I guess you're right. I'm not complaining, but because I'm an actor on The Big Bang and on Derek and Simon, it was sort of more of like it was more of an insight into my sensibility. What I we were telling the stories as opposed to.
But just, you're also a writer, so you were probably a little more emotionally invested in that than a song giving you a script.
Yeah, and then I came, and then Big Bang came along, and it was, and so I don't even go into. I shut. Well, first of all, I don't need to go into that part of my brain, the writing part, because the writing is so phenomenal on that show. It's a different sensibility than something like Derek and Simon. And I always felt, first and foremost, I was an actor anyhow. So I was elated to get to walk into this show. I mean, this Big Bang was just a pilot when we did it, but to be a part of this thing.
Did you know it was going to be? I'm never gonna have to work again. I'm gonna be a name.
Can you imagine if that was how I approached it?
Did you?
No, I'd be a lunatic if I thought like that.
What did you think when they first cast you in it? Because nerds weren't really in.
No, I mean it was a weird moment. I was doing Studio 60. So speaking of sketch comedy and that thing, which was Aaron Sorkin's show about kind of the behind the scenes of SNL, and it was a very dramatic version of it, but it was. And I thought, this is it. I get to do characters, and I get to say Aaron Sorkin's dialogue, and do the sketch comedy and do behind the scenes. It's like, it was a dream.
Right, and then that show was going to be supposed to be on forever.
Oh my
too.
God, it was
it's
like,
Aaron Sorkin.
It was like you've made it.
Right,
and I auditioned, and my audition was like an SNL audition. I had to do a bunch of characters and impressions. And then I had to do a scene from the show, and it was with Aaron. He was reading, and it was like wild. And I had one of the best auditions, if not the best. And I left. I said, if I don't get this, then I don't understand. And I didn't get it. I didn't get it. And it wasn't until later, before they shot the pilot, though, he called me in, and he had this meeting. It was a very like mafiosa meeting. It was him and Tommy Schlamme, and they basically said, "Thank you for coming in today." Well, thank you. Yes, they said, "Listen, you're going to read a lot of pilots, a lot of scripts out there this year, a lot of great people. But we happen to think that what we have here is the best." And I was like, "Yes." And they're like, "So what we're asking you is, would you like to join the cast of?" And Aaron's like, "Would you like to join the cast of Studio?" So, you know, it's like, and I was like, "Well, yeah." And he took me into the writer's room and made me do a bunch of impressions, and I got it, and I ended up. That was a different role than I had auditioned for, and it was smaller. And so when Big Bang came along, I said, "No, I don't want to do that."
You turned it down?
Yeah, I didn't really want to.
Who changed your mind?
The police. Chuck owns the police. No,
Chuck Lorre.
Yeah, Chuck Lorre, yeah. No. Well, actually, Chuck did kind of. He did sort of. I eventually said, I'll go in an audition, you know, because it's good to do that. And because I kind of didn't. I thought, I'm already on the show. I was very relaxed in the audition, and I did a good job. And they said, "We want you to come and test for CBS." And I said, "That's when I said no. I'm on this other show." And
which works well in Hollywood, doesn't it? Sometimes
it does. Yeah. I think it made Chuck probably like really angry and passionate. And he called, and I think he was like, "Why?" To my agent, and she said, "Well, he's on Studio 60," and he said, "But no one's watching Studio 60," which, I don't think he was. I'm sure he's a huge. Everyone loves Aaron Sorkin, but at that time, people really weren't.
Right.
Had already kind of not been working as a show, or at least popularity wise. And I said, "Fine." I just didn't want to play nerds anyway. I played so many nerds. I thought the script was so great, but I thought I finally made it. I get to do comedy and drama with Aaron Sorkin, but I did think the Big Bang script was terrific, and. I just went in and I did the pilot. I had to ask Aaron to let me out to do the pilot. And if the pilot got picked up, I would have had to leave Studio 60. So that was also the other thing. I didn't want to, after that mafiosa type me, I didn't want to
you
go with these guys.
You didn't want your kneecaps busted.
Yeah, once you're in, you can't get out. Right. So, but Aaron said, I wrote him an email and I said, "Is this okay?" And he said, "You fucking ungrateful son of a." And then he said, "Just kidding. They'd have to pry the pen out of my cold, dead hands to stop writing for you." It was really nice. And then I thought Big Bang will be. I did a lot of failed pilots. I was used to getting your health insurance, taken care of, making enough money for that. Do a pilot a year. It doesn't go on, even if it's great. But this one, this did feel special when we shot it. And I would have never guessed.
So in Florence Foster Jenkins, you play opposite Hugh Grant and Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
I would imagine that it's got to be like a master class of acting, working with these two, especially Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
What did you learn from working with her?
Nothing. No.
Honestly, what did she work? Totally. What did she learn from working with you?
Thank you. I didn't want to. I was trying to give you the subtle nudge. Well, it's hard to even. It was a masterclass, and because of that, it was sometimes I actually would just sort of get lost watching, you know, like you would in a class. I would, oh, it's my line, but I just, God, I can't believe how she did. What did she just do? And I guess I learned to sort of try to make it simple. I really learned about surrendering, I guess, to the unknown, and that all the work you do and all the preparation, which is a tremendous amount, particularly for this movie with the music and historical, these people, you know, are existed. And there was so much going into it. I was scared, and it was all these, you know.
What were you scared about? Because this is your first main, I mean, you're the third lead.
Yeah, it's, it was a lot. Well, it was that, and it was Meryl and Stephen and Hugh and the opera, the music, the tone, the, just going into that world with these people. I think the pressure was high, and there was a lot to do, honestly, between learning all of that music and acting on top of it. And we shot all of the music is live that you see in the movie, so it's all, we did it all live in the moment.
And you're actually playing,
and
the
I'm
piano.
Playing everything. And she's
singing. But you have a piano background.
I do, but not to that level, and not in that genre of music, and not playing with Meryl Streep and portraying a character. It's, you know, as a whole. So really, I guess in terms of answering what I learned, I think it was I watched her kind of come in and much like improv, which it really is the same principle. It's you study improv and you take classes, and but you're certainly not standing at home figuring out what you're going to do in the show that night, and you're not standing on the side of the stage either figuring it out. You surrender and you go out and you live in the unknown, and that is the job, and that's what she does effortlessly, or seemingly, I guess, you know. It's but standing in front of the camera and being alive and trusting that all the work you did is there, and but you're not there to...
How long did it take you to get there on this set?
It took me like probably a couple weeks to kind of try to relax a little bit and try to do that and try to just trust that I can kind of... that I can surrender.
And the other thing, both in Big Bang and in this movie, you have terrific comic timing. Just terrific.
Thanks.
How does someone learn that?
Was that good? I just took a big pause.
Yeah. Okay. It was great for a podcast.
I wanted to make it really awkward.
Yeah.
I don't know how you learn it. I don't know. I don't know if you do learn it or what it is. I think that there's a musicality, you know, again, talking about music, but I mean, there is a rhythm. It comes from writing. It comes from... I understanding probably some kind of, there is a little bit of a magical thing there. I don't even know.
How does your music background help you with your comic timing? Do you hear melodies? Do you hear rhythms?
Yeah. I think you can kind of, you can hear how it's supposed to land, and how it, and it even, and then it's, hopefully you can kind of, again, not tie yourself too heavily to one version of it, but there is, you know, with good writing and people that are actually listening to each other, there should be a natural rhythm to it, I think. And just growing up around funny people and watching funny things, I think it's in your bones, or it's not. I don't know.
How your dad was at the Groundlings. How does he feel about your career today?
I think that he's proud. I think that it's definitely, you know, he had a nice run at different points in his career, and it's, it's funny, I've played characters that are somewhat similar to the ones that he had played, and then many that are very different too in this movie, you know, like it's an interesting thing. I think that whenever you've got like family in the same business, you know, it kind of creates a the dynamic is sort of funny because you're he knew the sort of the pitfalls that there were in this business.
Did he warn you?
Yeah, I mean, my parents never discouraged me from it, but because it's in the family, it's they've seen ups and downs, and so I think going into it, also as any parent would, it's a ridiculously hard thing to do, to make it, and having seen it, you know, my dad having had successes and failures like everybody, I think you get a little bit, you want to protect your kids a little. So there was a moment where they were like, well, and then I dropped out of school. I said, let me just study it at least. I want to study. And I did study for a couple of years and then I dropped out and they were, that was, you know, didn't go over well. And
your mom was in casting.
Yeah.
And what I find interesting is it seems like you're embracing that I can do this nerd character where you were resisting a little.
Yes.
Tell us about that. Deciding, okay, you know what? This is what I do.
Well, it's a big stretch to play this nerd. I had to study nerdy, awkward people. For a guy like me. You mean in terms of like, because my mom is a casting director?
Yeah. What did you say? You know what? What did you learn from the whole casting thing? Like, because there's a lot of people that listen to this podcast that want to do in TV and film.
Right.
And when you do improv and sketch, you can play anything you want.
Yeah.
But when you do TV and film, you got to be very specific on what you do.
I think that while most, you know, it's like most comic actors walk around saying, well, what I really want to do is drama, or what I really want to do is be in a band. And it's, you know, everyone ever wants to do the thing that they are supposed to be doing in one way or another because they have range and ability and all of these things. And it's great and true. And I think I think that was a moment for me. It wasn't that I know that I'm comfortable playing these kinds of characters, and I know that I'm good at playing these kinds of characters.
You also seem like this in Big Bang, you really enjoy it. What is it about it that you enjoy playing these nerdy characters?
I guess I feel a little alien in my own life and a little bit...
Even today, with all your success?
Well, yeah, I'm not in like a boo-hoo kind of way, but I think, you know, maybe I see things differently, or I feel uncomfortable, or I feel really like out of my element in situations where I'm comfortable, I guess, or so, you know, and there's something about or I see the comedy in situations, I guess, that where they're so closely linked to being tragic, sometimes they're funny to me as well, and I think that these characters have this kind of embracing of the human condition, which is sort of tragically funny. I mean, it's so short.
And you don't play these guys like, how do you play these nerds? You don't play them like losers, do you?
No, I mean, because that's also what is fun. And in when I went in for the Big Bang audition, I do remember one thing that happened and maybe it's because I was just kind of, because I was so popular at that time on Studio 60 that I didn't care. But I do remember thinking, well, you know, I don't want to play this guy so nerdy, you know, like I remember the scene I had to come in and do, it was, he comes over with this tape, video or DVDs of Stephen Hawking talking before he was unable to speak. And he's so excited because he's got this DVD of hearing, you can hear Stephen Hawking, and he comes in, he's ready to play. And then he finds out there's a girl in the apartment and he can't believe it. And I just, what I tried to do was be truthful, you know, and instead of commenting, I guess, on it. And I thought, what is this guy is so excited, and how can I get behind that and not be a nerd and be a guy and not sort of look down the bridge of my nose at these people? And so I guess that it's sometimes a challenge to do that and to really kind of find the life in them. And then that's what makes it fun, and I feel connected to them, and so it felt stupid to me, I guess, to answer your question, to say I don't want to do this thing. And I think you do the thing that you're good at, and that people, and in going into audition, it's like, for better or worse, this is how I look, and this is what people will connect to kind of on the surface when they see me, and I'm gonna do it, and I'm gonna embrace it because I love doing it. And then down the road, you know, I can play a Hell's Angel or a bouncer.
And you said that Stephen Frears, the director of this movie, he didn't even know your work.
No, no. And that was good because it allows people to just see you freshly, you know. And I don't think it would have hurt me. Maybe it would have. I don't know. But he trusted the casting director, Kathleen Chopin, who, you know, and that is a good little lesson. Is I made this very small movie. She was a casting director on it. Not a lot of people saw the movie. I was actually a director as well. I directed with my wife, and she cast it. A year later, she happened to be casting this, and I was just on the forefront of her mind.
What's the lesson?
The lesson is work with Kathleen Chopin. She works on this tremendous movie. No, the lesson is work begets work. I mean, it's kind of a cliche, but I while I made this smaller movie, We'll Never Have Paris, it was like my story. I wrote it, I was in it, directed with my wife. It was personal, it was hard, and then, you know, it was small. And I thought, oh God, what? At a certain point, I thought, why even do this? It's so much work. No one, you know, to get the movie out there and to get it seen by people is so hard. What's the point? And then, aside from having something you're proud of, even if no one sees it, but then you realize, wait a minute, I made this, and because of that, I met Kathleen, and because of Kathleen, I'm now going to get to do this other movie. And sometimes you can't see the sort of inner workings of that, but I really do believe you have to work, you have to put up work. And I used to do it for years, buying out, you know, paying to play at the Second City in LA, which was really just like a space. They didn't even have a company, but we'd pay them, buy out the theater on Saturday nights, and write shows and do it for years. We did it for years, and we did well. But and that's how I just think, if you put it up, if you have to get up on stage, and you go on those auditions and you don't say no to, even if it's not Chuck Lorre, and even if you're not in the Sorkin mafia, you don't say no. I think you say yes, and then, you know, if you're lucky enough, one day you'll get to say no to things. But I think it was a good moment that I agreed.
We're going to wrap this up. Yeah. Thank you so much. We asked the same question to everybody. What one piece of advice would you give somebody starting out in comedy or improv today?
Oh, I wish I saved my last answer for this. Well, to sort of piggyback on my... to quote myself, I would say, you know, finding a space to get up and stand on stage and perform is, you can't do it alone, and there's so much opportunity. And I guess now you could do it at home, and you could film yourself and put things out into the world. So I would say, just doing the thing, getting up and doing it, and for a long time, for years. And you'll know right away, I think, if you love it, or if you feel the need that you have to do it. I think you have to do it, to do it.
And how will you know you love it? Let's say you're not making any money, you've been doing it for 15 years.
Well, even if you love it, you're not always going to be without misery, too, I think, because you fail a lot, too. I think... I think it's, if you find yourself needing to do the thing, and going days, you go a few days without performing or whatever it is that you want to do. I think if it's something that doesn't really, you know, leave your head, then you probably, I mean, there's probably these voices, I'm sure everyone hears them, right? That, I don't know, you need to let it out. For me, it's just the way that I feel like I'm able to express all of the bizarre things going on in my psyche, and therefore I kind of need it. Even when I feel miserable or feel like I've failed, it's kind of a compulsive thing.
Simon Helberg, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
That was very fun.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd. It's in the can, and I want to thank our guest, Simon Helberg. And check out his new movie, Florence Foster Jenkins, which opens in theaters August 12th. And I'd also like to thank Sam Bowers, our director of Improv Nerd, and our producer, Dan Schiffmacher. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning workshops, classes, and intensives, The Artist Low Comedy, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also sign up for the Improv Nerd blog. And follow us on social media. I'm always on social media. You should always be on social media. Go to our Improv Nerd Facebook page and like us. Also, Follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd, and then our great Improv Nerd YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, and see clips from our live shows. We're lucky to be part of this wonderful podcast collective called Feral Audio. So check out all the great podcasts on feralaudio.com. I'd like to thank both our sponsors today, the Green Bay Improv Festival and the Tampa Bay Improv Festival. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. And he's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat.
I help people.
She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My